A warning, this episode features dramatizations and discussions of violent death and dismemberment. Listener discretion is advised, especially for listeners under 13. Something to note, the story you're about to hear is not a direct retelling of any single myth about the manticore. Today's episode combines elements from a number of legends and stories about this deadly chimera for dramatic effect. Welcome to Mythical Monsters. I'm Vanessa Richardson. Every week, we tell the stories of some of humanity's most legendary creations. Our ancestors invented these mythic beasts in order to make sense of the world around them. By revisiting the tales of these epic forces of destruction, maybe we can better understand the world of today. Last week, we examined one of the first modern cryptids. El Chupacabra is a blood-sucking reptile that began attacking farm animals in Puerto Rico in the summer of 1995. Since then, it's become a global phenomenon, killing dozens of animals all throughout the Americas. If you haven't heard the story yet, be sure to give it a listen. Today, we're taking a look at a creature that dates back to the 4th century BCE. The manticore is a chimera with the body of a lion, the tail of a scorpion, and the face of a human man. With its disconcerting appearance and voracious appetite for human flesh, the manticore would eventually make a name for itself as the ultimate symbol of evil. You can always find episodes of Mythical Monsters for free on Spotify, along with all other Parcast originals. We'll discuss the origins of the manticore right after this. The first recorded mention of the manticore comes from a Greek doctor named Ctesias, who was born in the early 5th century BCE. As a physician who served in the Persian royal court for nearly 2 decades, Ctesias encountered a number of visitors from the neighboring lands of the Indus River Valley. He collected their stories into a book titled Indica, or The History of India. In that text, Ctesias tells of the legendary Marticora, an animal that he claims to have seen firsthand when it was presented as a gift to the Persian king Artaxerxes II. The description that Ctesias gives is of a bizarre monster with the body of a lion, the head of a human, and the tail of a scorpion. It catches careless travelers by wading in the bushes and raising its long, thin neck above the foliage. When people pass by, they see only the face of a blue-eyed old man popping up out of the greenery. When they approach to help the man, the manticore pounces, shooting them with the stingers from its tail and ripping them to shreds. The existence of Ctesias' Marticora was hotly debated by the writers and philosophers of ancient Greece and Rome. Some took Ctesias at his word, while others questioned whether the beast he saw was nothing more than an extraordinary tiger. Most of Ctesias' works were forgotten long ago, but the story of the manticore was kept alive by the scholarly community of the 1st and 2nd centuries. Medieval writers would draw on these works when creating their popular bestiaries. The unsettling illustrations that accompanied these texts would solidify the image of the creature, forever fixing the picture of this strange chimera in our collective cultural consciousness. The word manticore derives from the Persian word meaning man-eater. That this creature was literally named for the consumption of men speaks to its identity as a monster of untamable appetite. During the Middle Ages, the manticore came to symbolize the idea of animal voraciousness, a quality associated with the sins of lust and greed. Part of what makes the manticore so unsettling is the incongruity of a human face imposed onto a dangerous animal. When we look at a manticore, we worry that we're seeing a reflection of the insatiable appetite for violence that exists within ourselves. Irv Minerva held tightly to the sides of the howdah as the elephant made its way through the thick jungle foliage. It had been months since he'd been outside the city walls. In fall, his father had gotten word that Artaxerxes' forces were camped in the valley outside Taxila. All winter long, men had patrolled the battlements, scanning the horizon for invaders. At the first sign of spring, King Batia sent out riders to look for the Achaemenid army. The men came back with good news. Artaxerxes' armies were gone. Batia was free to lead the first of the yearly hunts. As they neared the steep bank of a river, Batia held up a hand for the party to halt. He pulled on the elephant's reins, and she came to a stop in the middle of the path. For a moment, everything was still and quiet. Erva could see that his father was listening intently. Erva concentrated on the different sounds of birds and insects as his father had taught him to do. Gradually, he picked out a sound that stood out from the rest. It was faint at first, but when he listened close enough, Erva was able to hear the high-pitched whistle of a flute. It sounded like someone was walking towards them while playing a banzuri. The sound sent shivers up his spine. The men turned towards the music, waiting in tense silence. Erva noticed movements in the bushes. A ripple ran through them like a serpent moving through water. It was the manticore. A face rose up from the dense greenery. Erva frowned. He hadn't expected this. A young boy was peering up out of the bushes. He was not much older than 6 or 7. His face was round and chubby-cheeked, with striking blue eyes and a mane of shaggy red hair. Batia knocked his arrow and pointed it toward the boy. For a moment, Erva wanted to stop him, but then he remembered his father's warning. Batia had said the manticore would show them its human face at first, but Erva had always imagined an evil old man. He hadn't realized that hunting a young manticore would mean putting an arrow through the face of an innocent child. The other archers aimed their arrows at the boy. They were waiting for Batia's command. For a tense moment, no one moved. The child in the bushes just stared at them with his big blue eyes. Then he opened his mouth, revealing 3 rows of pointed white fangs. The manticore leapt forward, displaying the powerful body of a scarlet lion. Batia gave the signal, and the archers began firing. The manticore snarled as the volley of arrows sank into its flesh. It lunged at the elephant nearest to it, sinking its teeth into her thick gray skin. Blood spurted out over the writhing feline beast. The elephant reared up onto its hind legs, trumpeting in pain as the manticore dug deeper into her flesh. The men who had been riding her were thrown to the ground. The manticore released the elephant and leapt down to the earth. 2 of the men managed to get to their feet and run towards the woods, but the 3rd had been hurt in the fall. He wasn't moving. The manticore stalked toward the man on the ground. It licked its lips, showing off its glistening white fangs. Batia jumped to the ground and unsheathed his sword. The creature turned to face him. It flicked its armored tail, and Batia instinctively flinched. The manticore seized the moment. It leapt towards him with its claws outstretched. Batia swung his sword out in front of him, catching the creature by the shoulder. The manticore made a noise like a trumpet and stepped backwards, pulling the sword out of Batia's hands and sending them both crashing to the ground. Erva gasped, Without thinking, he seized the elephant's reins and gave her a hearty whack on the side. She broke away from the others and charged toward the manticore. For a moment, the creature was cowed. It sank into a crouching position before springing up again. Its face twisted into a grimace of rage as it sank its claws into the elephant's massive foot. Irva held on for dear life as the elephant tried to smash the manticore into the ground. The beast wrapped himself around her leg, gnawing at it and pulling off great chunks of flesh. Bhatia rolled over. He reached for his sword and swung it at the hard red shell that encased the manticore's curved stinger. The shell cracked in two, releasing a flood of pus and black blood. The creature gave a cry and released its grip on the elephant. It fell to the ground with a whimper before slinking off into the nearby bushes. His heart still pounding, Irva jumped to the ground. He ran to his father and asked if they should go after it, but Bhatia shook his head. "We've done what we came to do." Ctesias's description of the manticore is the only eyewitness account of the creature ever recorded. Though the original text was lost sometime after the 10th century CE, historians have gotten a sense of it through summaries and reviews written by later authors. Ctesias's Indica, or History of India, was one of the first depictions of India to be widely circulated throughout the Western world. It was immensely popular with the great Roman scholars of the 1st and 2nd centuries. Famous thinkers like Pliny the Elder, Aristotle, and Plutarch all read and reviewed Ctesias's works. To the Greeks of the 3rd century BCE, India was a land of incredible exoticism. It was a fantastical country located on the literal edge of the world. The monsters, real or imagined, that lived there were just as magical as the place itself. Ctesias describes how the manticore can launch its foot-long, infinitely regenerating stingers as far as 100 feet. He says its voice sounds like a trumpet or a flute. Hunters fight it from atop the safety of armored elephants, the only creatures impervious to the manticore's sting. Even from an elephant's back, the hunters still only dare to kill juvenile manticores, crushing their stingers before they can develop into dangerous menaces. Swift as a stag, powerful as a lion, and with an insatiable hunger for human flesh, the manticore is either the product of a powerful imagination or the world's deadliest predator. As the jovial hunting party made their way back to the city, Irva spotted a pillar of black smoke rising from the trees. A terrible silence fell as they came in sight of the great gate. Bodies littered the ground around the red brick battlements. Flames leapt from the tops of the domed stupas and palace towers. Something was very wrong. After the break, Irva and his father encounter an enemy they cannot defeat. Now, back to the story. The hunting party had been a riot of laughter and happy chatter as they made their way back to Taxila. But the men went quiet as soon as they came in sight of the city gates. Flames erupted from behind the red brick walls, and Irva could hear the distant sounds of screams and fighting. They had thought that the Achaemenid armies were gone. Irva's father had said they were safe to leave Taxila for the yearly manticore hunt. He had been wrong. King Bhatia called out to one of the men on horseback, "They've taken the city. Ashoka, take my son and ride east toward the hills. Don't stop until you reach the monastery at Mora." Irva interrupted his father's orders. "Let me come with you. If I'm old enough to kill a manticore, then I'm old enough to fight." Bhatia shook his head sadly, replying, "If the Achaemenid armies find you, they'll kill you on the spot. It will be the end of the line of succession and the end of our people." An arrow came to land at the feet of his father's elephant. Erva looked up to see the iron gates opening. A great cry rose up as men flooded out of the city. They wore the colorful robes of the Persian infantry, the 10,000-man battalion known as the Immortals. Bhatia screamed, "Go, I'll hold them off." Erva leapt down from the howdah and onto the back of the waiting horse. They galloped east as Bhatia led the charge into the city gates. Erva looked back just as they were disappearing into the woods. Immortals surrounded his father. Bhatia was fighting them off two-handed, but there were too many. Erva watched as a spear erupted through his father's chest in a spray of blood. Bitter tears sprung to his eyes as the scene disappeared from view. In that moment, Erva swore that no matter what happened, no matter where he went or what became of him, someday he would have revenge on the men who had killed his father. Erva's stallion whinnied as it pulled the heavy cart through the forest. The landscape of the Gandhara Mountains was beautiful, but Erva took little pleasure in it. It had been nearly 15 years since the day the Achaemenid army had captured his father's kingdom. Once the Persian forces spread far and wide over the Indus Valley, Erva knew he could never hope to take back his land. But he would have the next best thing. Vengeance. He'd thought about working his way into the palace and killing Artaxerxes in his sleep. He'd even traveled to Persia to learn the language and customs, but in the end, it seemed too risky. He'd considered poison, shooting the king with arrows, or setting fire to the palace, but every plan had faults. Erva knew he would only get one chance. Whatever he did, it would have to be foolproof. He wanted the king to suffer as he had suffered. For years, he'd wandered the Persian countryside, working for food and searching for a way to kill King Artaxerxes II. Then one day, as if by magic, a plan had come to him. He'd been working as a bricklayer outside Apadina Palace when a parade of elephants passed by. He hadn't seen an elephant in years, not since the day his father died. Suddenly, Erva remembered something his father had said to him as a boy. The words came back with perfect clarity. "We hunt the young because they haven't developed their stingers yet. Once it's fully grown, the barbs are lethal. Not even armor will protect against them. The manticore's stinger can pierce anything but an elephant's hide." It was like a moment of divine inspiration. Erva had seen the whole plan laid out before him. He would not kill Artaxerxes. He would let the manticore do it for him. Erva spotted the place he'd been looking for, a black hole sheltered by rocks. He left the cart and walked the horse into a thicket of trees where it would be safe. Erva took a deep breath, pulled the hood of his elephant skin cloak around his shoulders, and started toward the manticore's den. Of all the legendary creatures and places mentioned in Cestius's Indica or History of India, the manticore in particular seems to have drawn the attention of later Roman writers. Some, like the first century naturalist and philosopher Pliny the Elder, took the story at face value. Others accused Ctesias of exaggerating or theorized that he saw some other animal and only thought it was a manticore. A 2nd century geographer named Pausanias says he's inclined to think that Ctesias is actually describing a tiger. Ctesias served as the physician to King Artaxerxes II during the period when the Persian Empire occupied much of northern India. It's plausible that a tiger might have been brought to the court and presented as a gift to the area's new sovereign. Given that Ctesias' role at the Persian court was not a particularly important one, it's also likely that he may not have gotten the best look at it. Archaeologists have found images of human-tiger hybrids in the Indus River Valley, dating all the way back to the year 2500 BCE. The tiger is the largest of the big cats, and a Bengal tiger can grow to be 500 or 600 pounds. Tigers are denser in the Indian subcontinent than anywhere else on Earth, leading to an unusually high number of attacks on humans. Their hunting method is often described as feast or famine, though they'll sometimes go days between meals. When they do eat, tigers gorge themselves, sometimes consuming as much as 60 pounds of meat in a single sitting. This survival adaptation has earned the tiger a reputation as a particularly voracious eater. It's entirely plausible that Ctesias might create a manticore out of an ordinary tiger. Perhaps poor translation or a gullible nature helped to form Ctesias' description of the strange, man-eating figure of the manticore. Both are creatures of unparalleled might, with a nearly godlike status in an ancient Indian culture. They're also sharp-toothed killers with an astonishing appetite. Of course, only one of these creatures had a particular taste for human flesh. Erva's plan to capture the manticore was simple. He was going to bait it into a trap. No one had ever accomplished this before, but he would use something that he knew a manticore couldn't resist: a live human. Erva approached the deep black hole in the earth. His heart was racing, but his hands were steady. He dragged the metal box to the edge of the hole and raised the two doors before pulling on his coat of bulky gray leather. Surprisingly, acquiring an elephant skin coat had been the easiest part of the plan. He'd traveled back to the city of Taxila in the guise of a beggar. The ivory trade had flourished there ever since the city fell to the Achaemenids. Often, the traders didn't even bother using the elephant skin. The hard part had been finding the den of a manticore. It wasn't the sort of thing most people went looking for. His father had been an expert at finding and tracking the elusive beasts, but he'd died before he could teach Erva much more than the basics. Erva spent almost a year searching. At first, he'd hoped to speak with villagers who'd been witness to manticore attacks, but there weren't many who'd been left alive. From the few people he'd managed to talk to, he'd gleaned that there was a manticore living somewhere in the foothills of the Gandhara Mountains. He'd spent months tracking the beast across windswept plains and through snow-covered evergreen forests. Then one day, it was nearing dusk when Erva heard a sound that made his hair stand on end. It was the delicate whistle of a bansuri. Erva pulled on his elephant skin coat and hid behind some bushes. Covered in the cracked gray leather, it was almost impossible to distinguish him from the rocky hillside. He waited as the music got louder and louder. Then the creature emerged from a dense copse of trees. Erva didn't dare to breathe. It was fascinatingly grotesque. There was something so unsettling about seeing the face of a harmless old man attached to the lethal body of an enormous feline. For a moment, the manticore sniffed at the air and looked curiously in his direction. The creature was at least 200 feet away from him, but Irva still felt his blood run cold. The creature sighed and made its way in the direction of the distant hills. Once it was gone, Irva leapt out from his hiding spot and followed in its footsteps. It wasn't long before he reached the manticore's den. Irva had barely slept that night. For years, he'd only thought about accomplishing this one thing, and now he was closer than he'd ever been. Killing Artaxerxes would probably mean the end of his own life, but Irva didn't feel sadness or nerves. He climbed into one of the open ends of the box and waited for the manticore to emerge from its hole. Coming up, Irva finally has his bloody revenge. Now, back to the story. Irva's heart pounded as he settled himself in the metal box that he'd designed to trap the manticore. It was large, at least 6 feet wide and 5 feet tall. Two metal doors slid up at both ends and were locked in place. A lever attached to a chain could send both doors crashing back down at a moment's notice. Irva held the end of the chain in his sweating hand. All he had to do now was wait. He'd been waiting for 15 years to get revenge on the Persian king. Now he was only a few steps away from the culmination of a lifetime of work. He tried to steady his breathing as he wondered how long it would take for the manticore to emerge. Then he realized he didn't need to wait at all. Irva leaned over the hole and called out, "Come up! There's fresh meat up here!" Irva thought he made out movement in the inky blackness. He rapidly drew back to the edge of the box. As flute music rose up out of the hole, Irva smiled to himself. The monster had taken the bait. He could hear the manticore digging its talons into the dirt walls, clawing its way towards the surface. Finally, the creature emerged. Irva's heart skipped a beat. It was just as he'd hoped. The creature had climbed right to the edge of the box. If it wanted to eat him, it had no choice but to enter the trap. Irva pulled on the thick leather hood of his elephant skin coat. The gray leather made for an awkward garment, but it was the only thing that could protect him from the manticore. For a moment, it just looked at him with its wide blue eyes. Irva almost forgot what he was looking at. All he could see were the sad eyes of a tired old man. Then it smiled, revealing its mouthful of pointed teeth. The creature crawled out of the hole and shot a foot-long stinger directly at him. Irva flinched as it bounded off the cracked gray leather. The creature gave a trumpeting cry of frustration and pulled itself further out of the hole. Then it stopped. It began to edge its way around the hole. Irva's mouth dropped open. The creature was clever. It didn't want to enter the box. It was trying to get him from the other side. The manticore came up from the hole and leapt in front of the box. Irva didn't have time to think. He frantically crawled to the other side, pulling out the knife at his belt. The creature gave him an unsettling grin and began advancing. He still held the trigger that would close the walls of the box, but doing it now would mean trapping himself inside too. Irva held out the knife in a shaking hand. The creature knocked it away with a single swipe of its massive paw. It gave a triumphant cry. Irva looked down at the hole below him. There was only one choice. He took a deep breath and jumped into the den. The manticore leapt at him, but it was too late. He pulled the chain, triggering the walls of the trap and catching it inside. Irva tumbled down the hole, landing on a soft pile of soil. Above him, he could hear the manticore crying out from within the metal box. Irva immediately tried digging his nails into the walls of the hole, but the earth was too loose. Every time he tried to pull himself up, the dirt collapsed around him. He could see that he was in a wide, low burrow. The space was filled with a thick, musky odor and the iron tang of blood. Irva squinted at what he could now see was a pile of objects. He took a few steps closer and leaned in. Irva shrieked. It was a pile of human bones. He backed into the entrance and dug his hands desperately into the walls, but it was no use. He sat on the ground and put his head in his hands. He tried to think. He had to get out of here. Suddenly, Irva was struck with a terrible idea. He went back to the pile of bones and pulled out two long ones. One still had a scrap of flesh clinging to it. Irva grimaced as he pulled it off and tossed it back on the pile. He went back to the hole and plunged the bones into the walls. They stuck. With tremendous effort, he climbed upward, away from the den. When he finally emerged, he was filthy and out of breath. But for the first time in years, he was grinning from ear to ear. He'd done the impossible. He had trapped a manticore. The manticore's popularity waned during the period from the 5th to the 8th centuries, but interest in the mythical monster was renewed when it began appearing in the bestiaries of the Middle Ages. These encyclopedic volumes often expanded upon the creature. Some manuscripts added wings or horns to their illustrations. Others augmented the legend of the manticore, claiming it was a burrowing creature who lived underground and spewed forth plague onto those unlucky enough to get close to it. Because of its human face, the manticore is sometimes thought of as a cannibalistic creature. During the Middle Ages, authors seized on this perversity, making the manticore emblematic of evil. Dante used a manticore-like creature to represent fraud in his literary journey into hell. The bestiaries that featured the manticore often chose to emphasize the voracious hunger of the creature. They made special mention of the fact that it refuses to attack single travelers, waiting instead for groups of three or four so that it can truly slake its gluttonous lust for flesh. The manticore had always been a creature of rapacious hunger. Now it also embodied the carnality and sins of the flesh that were so reviled by medieval Europeans. It had become a frenzied killer, utterly taken by bloodlust. Its three rows of teeth were more than just a part of its body. They were the unstoppable slaughter machine that would rip apart whole armies of men just to satisfy the hunger of a single beast. Ctesias stood at the back of the crowd of onlookers, craning his neck to get a better look at the metal box that sat in the center of the room. He shook his head. This wouldn't do at all. Ctesias had spent nearly 17 years in the palace of King Artaxerxes II, and if he had learned anything, it was how to get the best seat at court. He snuck out through the great brass doors at the front of the room. He went down the hallway to the left and found himself facing a small, unassuming wooden door. The door led to a creaking staircase that zigzagged up to the top of the hall. The servants used this passageway to relight the torches in the copper sconces near the ceiling. Ctesias peeked out of one of the small doors concealed within the ornate carvings of the palace walls. From here, he had a perfect view of the scene below. The visitor stood facing the grand marble throne of King Artaxerxes II. Next to him was a large metal box. He was a handsome young man with a prominent nose and a thick head of black hair. He was dressed in a strange gray coat of thick, cracked leather. His name was Erva, and he claimed to be the son of the deposed king of Taxila. He had come to present a gift and pledge his fealty to King Artaxerxes II. Of course, the crowd of curious onlookers was not there to marvel at the young man. They had come to see the gift. Erva claimed to have caught a live manticore. Ctesias had heard tales of the legendary beast with the body of a red lion and the face of a man, but he'd always assumed that they were exaggerations or outright lies. He was just as curious as everyone else to see what the young man had concealed within the metal box. The guards standing beside the king's throne put their bronze karnas to their lips and played the five notes that signaled the king's impending entrance. Beside them, drummers beat a steady rhythm that echoed menacingly around the stone walls of the courtroom. King Artaxerxes II emerged from a pair of silver doors, and the crowd knelt as one. He seated himself on the throne and called for silence. In a booming voice, Artaxerxes called for Erva to step forward. The young man moved in front of the metal box and bowed deeply. He addressed the king in a voice of uncanny calmness. "My liege, I've come this day to present you with a rare gift, your just reward for all you have done in Taxila." Artaxerxes smiled pleasantly and leaned forward in his chair. "I thank you, Erva of Taxila, and I assure you, your gesture will not go unrewarded. I will allow you to return to the city of your birth unharmed. Your exile is at an end. You may even join the Persian infantry if you so choose. The Immortal Guard is always in need of more soldiers." Erva gave the king a tense smile and said, "Your generosity knows no bounds, but please, it is time I presented my gift." The young man pulled the hood of his coat up over his face. He stepped away from the box and tugged on a lever that caused the doors on either end to rise. The creature that stepped out of the box was like nothing Ctesias had ever seen before. It was at once magnificent and appalling. It pursed its lips, and the sound of a gentle flute came forth. For a moment, the court was frozen in awe. Then the manticore raised its tail and began to shoot. One after the other, the long black barbs of its tail whizzed through the air, hitting the line of armed men who stood behind the king. They pierced their armor, striking before a single man could draw his sword. One after the other, the men's faces turned purple, then blue. Yellow bile rose to their lips. They fell to their knees as the creature advanced on their king. The crowd of onlookers began to scream and run for the doors, but there were too many of them. As they clambered over one another, the manticore released another round of barbs. They flew over the crowd, hitting the ones closest to the doors. The people dropped like flies, the dead weight of their bodies blocking the room's only exit. Ctesias wanted to look away, but he felt transfixed by the scene in front of him. The manticore leapt onto the throne and grabbed hold of the king's arm. It braced itself against the chair and wrenched the arm out of its socket in a flood of blood and viscera. It dropped the arm and bounded back into the crowd. It clawed and bit at the screaming courtiers, releasing thick sprays of blood. It trumpeted loudly and shot its stingers at anything that moved. All the while, the young man in the gray coat did not move from his spot. He just stood there in the center of the room, laughing maniacally. It was the hysterical howl of a madman. Ctesias wanted to do something. He wanted to stop the gruesome scene below, but there was nothing he could do. He closed the trap door and fled down the stairs. He raced out of the palace and made for the harbor. He could get on a boat and go back to Greece. He'd do whatever it took to ensure that he never saw another manticore again. It's been over 2,000 years since Ctesias apparently glimpsed the manticore in the gilded halls of the Persian court. Yet the creature still holds a grip on the hearts and minds of the Western world. Its resurgence in the bestiaries of the Middle Ages led to its being featured prominently in the art and architecture of the Renaissance and late medieval period. At that time, the manticore was an emblem of wickedness, a useful metaphor for the sins of lust and greed. As time went on, the manticore drifted away from its status as an icon of evil. It appeared in churches as a representation of the weeping prophet Jeremiah. This was a reference to an incident in which Jeremiah is cast into an underground pit as penance for his heretical prophecies. Some English families began using the manticore in the heraldic banners that represented the lineage of their house. Though the manticore was no longer a figure of pure evil, it maintained its association with greed and excess. Manticores with the faces of young women feature prominently in the allegorical Mannerist paintings of the 16th century, often representing lust or fraud. Today, the creature has appeared in everything from Salman Rushdie's controversial classic, The Satanic Verses, to the Harry Potter series. It's made an impression on recent generations through its role in the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing games. There it appears as a scorpion-tailed lion with bat-like wings. Despite these fictional depictions, there are places where the manticore still exists as a living legend. In the jungles of the Indonesian archipelago, rumors of roaming manticores abound. Villagers who claim to have seen the manticore say that when the beast attacks, it devours every last trace of its prey, even the bones. Whether it's pure evil or just a dangerous predator, the manticore is always consistent in its sheer appetite. Perhaps this creature, with its human face, is a representation of our own animal instinct. When it attacks, it does so with a gusto that belies a deep hunger, a gnawing appetite that can never be filled, no matter how many it kills. Once we have seen a human face on such a monster, we're inclined to recognize a little of that same beast when we look in the mirror. Thanks for listening to Mythical Monsters. We'll be back next week with a new episode. For more information on the manticore, amongst the many sources we used, we found the Ashgate Encyclopedia of Literary and Cinematic Monsters by Jeffrey Andrew Weinstock, extremely helpful to our research. You can find all episodes of Mythical Monsters and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Mythical Monsters, for free, from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Mythical Monsters on Spotify, just open the app and type Mythical Monsters in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Mythical Monsters was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound design by Brian Golub, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Isabella Way. This episode of Mythical Monsters was written by Zoe Louisa Lewis, with writing assistance by Greg Castro. I'm Vanessa Richardson.